You're listening to Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and across America. I'm your host, Ben Churchwell. This is the second of a two-part episode featuring Dr. John Knowles, an assistant professor of land atmosphere exchange in the Department of Land Resources and Environmental Sciences at Montana State University. His interdisciplinary research is broadly focused on how disturbances like drought, insect, fire, and climate change impact provisioning of ecosystem services throughout the western United States. He's particularly interested in bringing multi-scale lines of evidence to investigate feedbacks between carbon and water cycle processes. Dr. Knowles received his PhD from the University of Colorado Boulder and was a professor at California State University Chico before coming to MSU. One term that appears a lot in your research is Earth's critical zone. Could you define the critical zone for me?
Yes, Earth's critical zone was coined maybe a couple decades ago, mostly by the geoscience community, and tends to be defined as all of the interrelated processes that occur from the top of the treetops to the bottom of the bedrock. And it's a critical zone mostly because it's critical for supporting life on Earth. And when we talk about what's critical for supporting life on Earth, it's this interdisciplinary mix of geological, biological, hydrological, lithological processes that are intermingled in this very thin skin, really, at Earth's surface, that's really responsible for creating the conditions that have resulted in us living where we do.
Yeah. And we've already gotten into a little bit of this, but I'm curious, just broadly, to rephrase the question, in what ways might hydrologic changes in response to climate change influence other aspects of the critical zone in regions like southwest Montana?
The piece of the critical zone that I've been the most interested in so far and involved with is this idea that's got coined as dynamic water storage. And that can take many shapes, but the main thing that I would invoke with dynamic water storage is to think about kind of that sort of top of the soil zone. Gardeners will know what I'm talking about. Basically where the vegetation rooting zone is a good way to put it. So this is the zone from which vegetation draws its water. Dynamic water storage because it's dynamic in space and time. So we just kind of went through an example where if you kind of plotted something over the course of a typical year, in the mountains or the foothills of Montana, you'd accumulate snow through the winter, vegetation is dormant, snowmelt would start, vegetation would start waking up, you'd get really wet, saturated soils from the snowmelt pulse for, a month, maybe 2 months. There'd be tons of water supply on the landscape for vegetation, for wildlife, for everything. And then that would slowly dry down throughout the season. We get summer rain, but nothing like the giant snowmelt pulse. And kind of dry down through the fall and until we started it all over again. Picture for a minute, if you're on a hill top versus a valley, right? Same watershed. Maybe you're at the top of the watershed, the bottom of the watershed, or like I said, an upland versus a lowland. Well, that's going to shift that kind of template of water availability that I said quite a bit. So if you're in an upland, gravity's pulling on that water. There's right? It's going to move faster. It's going to, it won't hang out as long on the landscape, and things have to kind of be adapted to deal with, uplands are drier and etc. Versus if you're in the lowlands, maybe it'll take water longer to reach you per se, or maybe it won't. It all depends. But if you're in a kind of a topographical a spot where water pools, then you're going to have a lot more water for a lot longer, and you're going to be able to support much different types of vegetation community, right? Maybe think of a riparian corridor along a stream, wetlands, things like that. So when we're talking about the critical zone, we're talking about dynamic water storage. One of the main things that I think about is kind of this spatial variability. As you know, anybody that hikes around Montana is just going to see infinite permutations of this kind of like where water is likely to be in the subsurface at what times of year and for how long. And that's the key, right, to all of the really the plant and animal species that depend on that water.
And what kind of shifts in dynamic water storage are you seeing in relation to climate change? You've already gone into a few of them.
That's a great question. So the other piece of dynamic, right, the word meaning dynamic, is dynamic through time. Mm-hmm. And so we can go back to that kind of framework of snowmelt, pulse, and wet conditions that dry down over the course of the year. And now all of a sudden, maybe we get many years in a row of less snow. Maybe we get the same amount of snow, but the seasonality is different and it starts to melt earlier. So I'm trying to just invoke all of these kind of ways that the kind of template of snow melt and snow water recharge that we're used to in Montana could be tweaked with a warming climate in the future. So if we think about just this idea of slower snow melt, which is, you know, fairly high confidence that might happen earlier in the season at a slower rate in a warmer world, there might be more opportunity for trees to grab that slower moving snowmelt water as it passes through the subsurface, right, and trying to make its way to the stream, get sucked up and ultimately transpired up to the atmosphere and never make it into our streams or our aquifers. Or it's such a complicated process, depending on the timing of the vegetation, if it comes through before the vegetation is ready to grab it, maybe more of it makes it through to our streams. So simply just tweaking things, which are changing all the time, like the timing of snowmelt, the rate of snowmelt, those are going to have really big implications for kind of where that water ends up, the health of our ecosystems, and the amount of water that we have left over in our reservoirs and our aquifers.
Sure. To dive into another example of a feedback between the ecosystem and water storage, one of your recent studies considered the impact of bark beetle outbreaks on the hydrology of an ecosystem. What were the findings of this study?
Yeah, when I was in grad school at University of Colorado, the big thing at the time was bark beetles. The western U.S., this is like, you know, kind of 2008, 2010, the western U.S. just got decimated by this outbreak of bark beetles in the mountain forests. So for those that don't know or don't remember, bark beetles are an endemic species. They have always lived here. They're supposed to be here. That's not the issue. A lot of research has shown that warming temperatures, though, have sort of allowed the bark beetle population at that time to kind of not die off in the numbers that it used to during the winter. And there was an explosion of bark beetles in our forests. And so what they do is they attack a tree, you know, a groupings of trees, and they carry a blue stain fungus with them that gets in the tree. The tree ultimately, long story short, the tree ultimately dies. But it's different than if the tree died during like a wildfire or something, because all of the needles and everything are still there, right? They just become standing dead. And so, like I said, when I was in grad school, there's a lot of interest in, you know, trees are dying due to bark beetles. what's going to be the impact of this on our forested ecosystems? And so me being interested in evapotranspiration, I use the eddy covariance method, and I actually I used the eddy covariance method at one site that had been hit extremely hard by bark beetles in the snowy range in Wyoming, in southeast Wyoming, outside of Laramie. And I compared that to this Niwot Ridge, Colorado site that I mentioned earlier that didn't have a big bark beetle epidemic. So kind of a control site and a beetle site where the forest had been killed. And I took advantage of the fact that we'd monitored both of those sites with eddy covariance for, maybe at that time, maybe 15 years or so. And then I also, in this study, looking at the effect of bark beetles, compared the eddy covariance results to both satellite remote sensing of the entire western U.S., as well as a hydrological model that we can just run on a computer. And one of the really main ways that I like to do science is by comparing the eddy covariance with the satellite remote sensing and the model. So kind of three independent lines of evidence that didn't know anything about each other. I did a study where I contrasted those and looked at areas where all three methods gave a similar answer about the bark beetle effects on evapotranspiration. And I said, okay, me and my co-authors, during these periods or at these times, we have a high degree of confidence that this is what's happening, right? Satellites agree, eddy covariance and models, and this seems to be, you know, the situation. But by not over-relying on any one particular method and the biases that it might have, we're able to compare when the methods don't agree. And that's actually what gets to be really interesting, right? Those are the knowledge gaps that we can use to push the science forward. And so, like, what's going on here when the, you know, the eddy covariance says one thing and the model says another thing? And maybe we found a bias in the model, or maybe we found that the eddy covariance wasn't representative in that area, or what have you. But I felt like it was a really good study because we brought these three independent lines of evidence to bear, and that the main conclusions that we found that kind of were robust across all our methods was that if you kill a stand of forest with bark beetles, you're going to reduce evapotranspiration. And so given that water's neither created nor destroyed, that means that a greater percentage of precipitation that comes in should make it to our soils and our streams and our reservoirs, right? So maybe a good news story for water resources, right? If killing off the entire forest is good news. But what we were able to do, we didn't actually measure stream flow, so we're just measuring evapotranspiration. So that's a little bit kind of, all we can say is there's more water left over for other purposes. But what we could say is we could put a timeline on the forest recovery, which is really cool. And so by monitoring over, say, 15 years, we watched evaporation decline, then decline a lot, right, until we found the minimum evaporation from these forests relative to the control occurred in the ballpark of like 6 to 8 years following bark beetle outbreak. But after that, the forest started to come back, and it started to come back strong. And so we got with some foresters, and we figured out that this was likely a signal of what in forestry they call advanced regeneration. And so this isn't the forest resprouting from seed. That takes a really long time. But these are little saplings that did not, the beetles don't, they just kill mature trees. So there's little, you know, pine saplings littered throughout the forest that after a period of years, they start to get the benefits of all or many of the bigger trees have been killed. Sometimes ecologists think of this as competitive release. So there's a lot more water available in the landscape. After, you know, 5 years, 3 to 5 years, the beetles or the beetle-killed trees will become defoliated. They'll lose their needles. So there's a lot more sunlight reaching down onto the forest floor. And these small saplings that didn't get killed by beetles, after about 6 or 8 years, they started going nuts. They started growing really, really strong, which is a really great, you know, sign for our forests coming back. And we were able to detect that rebound in evapotranspiration such that after about 15 years, there was no longer any appreciable difference in forest evapotranspiration from before the beetle outbreak to after the beetle outbreak.
One of the focuses of your research explores nature-based solutions to reduce atmospheric CO2. What sort of nature-based solutions does your lab look at?
So this term nature-based climate solutions or natural climate solutions is pretty new, maybe the last, I'd say within about the last 10 years, it's really been gaining a lot of traction. It's something that I'm interested in because kind of at its core, the idea is that these are things, when we talk about solutions, we're talking about solutions to climate change and ways that we can mitigate the amount of CO2 that's accumulating in our atmosphere just through natural means or not by tweaking anything like fossil fuel combustion or anything like that, but maybe by changing the way that we manage our landscapes. And at its core, kind of at its best, these nature-based climate solutions have the potential to be win-wins, right? Both for the climate, but also for society. So the one that I've done the most work on is this idea of regenerative agriculture. So I was a professor in California at the time when I got a couple of grants to study this. It's something that I'm hearing there's a good amount of interest in Montana as well, with especially with ranching and what can we do, or is there anything we can do to be part of the solution? And so I can talk about what I did in California is, regenerative agriculture, it's taken me a long time to learn. I don't come from an agronomy background. And what does that mean? And what I've come around to is it doesn't mean the same thing in almost any two places, but it certainly doesn't mean the same thing to everybody. And what I can say, though, is that, you know, I've worked in all over California now, from the deserts down by the Colorado River and the Arizona border, in the San Joaquin Valley and in the Sacramento Valley in Northern California, thinking about all types of crops and working directly with farmers and producers in this research, is that two of the most, you know, common threads, things that seem to matter, are keeping live roots in the ground. So we can think of that as cover cropping as often as we can, and reducing tillage, right? Deep tillage, especially, as much as we can. And by doing those two things, in addition to, you know, whatever may or may not work at your part of the world, at your ranch or your farm, we have the potential to sequester more carbon from the atmosphere into soils where it might be able to start to get form mineral associations and could last for a long period of time. That's achieved by the plants, the cover cropping, the live roots, sucking up CO2 from the atmosphere and keeping it in the soil, or transitioning it to the soil. And the best way to keep it in the soil is by not tilling it very deep, break up those carbon aggregates, expose them surfaces to microbial activity, and that's the process by which carbon is decomposed and returned to the atmosphere by respiration. So I don't know that I have any results to share. I've learned a lot in this research. It's been ongoing for 2 to 3 years now, And you're not going to have any changes overnight, right? Like, you know, even if you're, as a grower, right, if you're interested in this, if you're interested in trying to, you know, do what you can to promote regenerative agricultural practices, it's going to take, you know, I would say, certainly from our initial results, it looks like it's going to take 5 or 10 years before we really start to see major changes in kind of the system as a whole. But that said, we're seeing for folks that have, you know, come to us wanting to participate in this research using eddy covariance again, right, to measure the carbon fluxes in and out of these landscapes, we're seeing carbon buildup in fields. We're seeing, right, so more fertile fields, the increased carbon is increasing soil health, which helps to retain water. So certain folks that we're working with are not having to water as much. And again, what I'm so excited about for regenerative agriculture and just any of these nature-based climate solutions is the goal here is to get to a win-win for the climate and the grower, right? Where they're going to have, hopefully, reduced costs associated with, right, not having to fertilize as much, fewer tractor passes, what have you, get better crop yields, richer soils. We talked about the water savings. So potentially more money in the hands of the farmers in addition to the carbon benefit savings that we're getting to our atmosphere. So I see this as, you know, an emerging field of research and management. I'm not kidding myself. I don't think it's a panacea, that it's a silver bullet that's going to stop climate change, but I think that it could be an important part of the solution.
Sure. Yeah, this question may not have an answer, but based off of maybe results in similar studies and how regenerative agriculture used in other systems, how expansive must an effort be in regenerative agriculture proliferating across the world? Would it take for the global atmospheric CO2 to be drawn down to a meaningful amount?
I don't think we can fix atmospheric CO2 through regenerative agriculture alone.
Sure.
There's, you know, the latest reports from bodies like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, they've got some really great infographics with data. I'd encourage people to check out that they put, you know, potential to mitigate against, right, CO2 buildup in our atmosphere. And so you can think about things like regenerative agriculture that we've been talking about has a sort of a carbon savings potential. Same as adding wind or solar, same as not cutting down our tropical forests, right? And the bottom line is that if we're going to get to a point where CO2 is not increasing in our atmosphere, or certainly not at the rate that it is now, that we're going to need contributions from all those sectors. And so one of the things I like about the IPCC graphic, anyway, that I'm thinking about, is that it also talks about cost associated with each of these, right? And it's kind of like feasibility. And so there's some easier and harder ways to get to that same goal. And, you know, regenerative agriculture, insofar as it has the potential to be a win-win for us and the environment, I think is certainly one of the ones that's worth checking out.
I got one more question for you. What are the most pressing and timely current challenges facing the critical zone in Montana?
That would be a good one to ask me in 25 years or so when I'm at the other side of my career. But, you know, as a relative newcomer to Montana, the kind of the issues that I'm most interested in getting involved with, one of them is water and water resources. Montana is blessed to have more water than many of the other states in the western U.S. But another way to think of it is we're kind of the headwaters of the headwaters, you know, the crown of the continent. We don't have a lot of storage. Even though we have a lot of water, it tends to leave our state pretty quickly, right? We don't have thick, developed soils, and certainly throughout all the mountains. And we want to keep it that way, right? We want to have enough water. And so a lot of the research I've described about how do different ecosystems or agro-ecosystems use water, how will they use water in a warmer world, how will they, you know, we know snow water is diminishing. That's going to have a big impact on kind of the timing and the magnitude of when we get our water, how we spread our water around the state. So all to do with water in terms of critical zone issues is a huge one for me. The other big one, right, and all these, you know, I know a lot of listeners are enthusiastic about wildlife, right? That's not my particular area of expertise, but wildlife and all of us live in the critical zone, and I'd argue these are just critically important for all manner of wildlife and people, you know, recreation activities and people that depend for wildlife on their livelihoods, etc. Is this idea of disturbance. And so I mentioned bark beetles was a big deal, right, when I was in grad school, and really by far and away throughout the West right now, wildfire is on everyone's minds, right? Not less people right here in Montana. And if we have warming, we will have drying, right? Lengthening growing seasons. Wildfire regimes are changing. And if it's not going to be wildfire, it's we're subject to drought, right? There's all kinds of disturbances out there, including climate change, which is not necessarily as punctuated as a wildfire, but is building up all the same. And so how will these various types of disturbances and potentially interacting disturbances come together to affect the way that somebody who looks out their window on Montana in 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, you know, what's the landscape going to look like that they see? And how healthy is that landscape going to be? And just really coming full circle to the start of our interview, how well is that landscape going to be able to provision habitat, clean water, clean air, right? All the things that we depend on landscapes for, you know, recreation opportunities, economy, tourism, you name it. That's a key part of my research.
Well, that's about all I have. Thank you so much for sitting down with us and for answering these questions, giving insights from your research. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ben. It was my pleasure. It really was.
This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. More information about the association and its activities can be found on its website, www.gallatinwildlife.org. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org or to buzzsprout.com and scroll down to Wilderness and Wildlife. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Ben Churchwell.